2-1 pitch, swing and a drive. Deep to right field, way up there, way out of here. Goodbye, baseball.
Eight strikeouts for the King tonight and make it 23 consecutive scoreless innings for Felix.
Strike three called on the outside corner, and there it is.
It's time for the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast.
Kyle Seager!
Here's your host, Gary Hill.
And it's time again for the Seattle Mariners Baseball Podcast. Thanks for being here once again. Gary Hill with you. Time to get ready for the Cleveland Indians. Three-game set. After an off day yesterday, back at it today. This podcast is excellent. We're going to be all over the place in this podcast. So the draft started yesterday. We're going to hear from the Mariners' first pick in the draft, and we'll hear about the Mariners' first two picks in the draft. That comes up, including a local product out of Oregon State. We'll have more on the draft, too, as we work our way through the draft as it continues, and also more on the top picks as we work our way through the podcast this week. We're going to visit with the newest Mariner pitcher, Vidal Nuño. He came over in the Arizona trade, made his debut a couple of days ago. We'll hear from him coming up. Mariners playing the Cleveland Indians tonight. Aaron Goldsmith sat down with Terry Francona, and it is hysterical. There's a couple of really funny stories in there, including about the time he interviewed for the Seattle Mariners manager's job. And he tells a pretty funny story about it, too. He's a great storyteller. He's been around, obviously, he's been around the game for a long, long time. So that comes. Also, there is a very funny story told by Dave Valley, and it's one of the great things that you get a chance to listen to on the podcast. Some things we just don't have time to air. So some things never see the light of day until the podcast. And this is a really funny story involving when Dave Valley was traded to Milwaukee and ended up in Robin Yount's house, renting his house. It's good. It's good. That comes up in a few minutes as well. Also, Dave Niehaus and his reading of Casey at the Bat. The anniversary was just a few days ago of Casey at the Bat being written, and Dave Niehaus, his reading of it, which is always outstanding. That comes up at the very end of the podcast. So it is a full one. First, let's take a quick look at what the Mariners are looking at the next 3 days. 4-10 start tonight. Reynes Elias, 2-3, 2.94 ERA. He has been excellent for the M's, but he goes up against Corey Kluber, 3-6, a 3.61 ERA this season. That's matchup number one tonight, 4-10 first pitch. Wednesday, Taiwan Walker will get the call, 2-6, a 5.80 ERA. He's pitched 8 innings each of his last two starts. He'll go against another big arm, Trevor Bauer, 5-2, a 2.94 ERA. And then breakfast with the Mariners on Thursday, 9-10 first pitch. Jay Happ, 3-1, a 3.31 ERA against Sean Markham, 2-0, a 5.19. That's the three-game series in Cleveland. That's how it looks as the Mariners look to get things cranked up. Offensively, will not be easy against Kluber and Bauer to start that series 1-2. But the Mariners look to get going and look to get game one started on the right foot and taking the first game in Cleveland. Well, the Mariners didn't play yesterday, but it was a big, big day for the organization. Draft day always is. The Mariners making two selections. They were without a first-round pick. They lost it with the signing of Nelson Cruz. Here's Tom McNamara talking about the very first selection they made in the draft yesterday.
We took Nick Neidert, high school pitcher from Peachtree City, Georgia. Lawrenceville, Georgia, I think it's Peachtree High School. I don't have my stuff in front of me, so I just ran up here. He was the guy we wanted. It was a long wait, and we were very happy that he fell to 60. We've been watching him for the last 2 to 3 years. He's about 6'1", 170. We see him as a projectable, loose, athletic kid, very confident. His fastball range is 93 to 97, mostly 93, 94. He's got good command. We think his slider's got a lot of potential. And he also features a changeup that he's got feel for. He's pitched in big spots down in Georgia in the perfect game showcases, Jupiter. So he knows what it's like to pitch in front of people. He's battle-tested for a high school kid. And last year down at the perfect game showcase in late October, he must have pitched in front of 5,000 people. Half of them were scouts. And he made an impression there on us. But our area scout, Dustin Evans, does South Georgia. This was his guy, so we kept our fingers crossed, and nice to take a high school right-hand pitcher with upside with a big fastball and control. We're really excited about him.
Tommy, he had some elbow tendonitis in the offs or the season.
Yep.
Any concerns about that?
Everything's cleared with the doctors. We went through it. We spent a lot of time the last 2 weeks. He also had mono earlier in the year, so... we went in, saw him at the end when he came back, and I flew in, and everything was coming out real good. And then he flew out to Safeco for a pre-draft workout. High school kid from Georgia flying across the country, gets out in the mound at Safeco Field, and it was like a business interview. Put the fastball here, put it there, put it there. And we were just impressed, and we've been watching him for the last couple of years. And like I said before, at 60, we were happily, pleasantly surprised he was there.
Tom, not a real big kid. Does he remind you?
You know, it's funny. When I heard someone on television say he's 6 foot, he's at least 6'1". He's got 3 inches on me, 2 inches. I might be shrinking, but he's getting taller. He's got a big rack of shoulders on him. He's got a lot of room to fill out. And he's real loose and athletic.
Tom, you mentioned that you've watched him for a few years now, and I imagine he's grown a little bit in that time. Well, what have you seen over those 3 years in his development?
It's funny. Last year when we saw him, we looked at him as, hey, this guy could be a consideration if we're picking 18 or 19 or 20. And the more we saw him, we thought that we were right. And then after we lost our first round pick, we kind of went in there cautiously optimistic. But he delivered. And, you know, he missed some time this year. Then he came back, and he was throwing very well. And everything was exactly what we saw in the summer. And then we brought him out to Safeco. And he threw at Safeco Field, and you know, we had our fingers crossed, and we were hoping he was the guy. We've been watching him for 3 years. High school Georgia baseball right now is real high profile, and the competition down there is really good. And you know, he's battle tested for a high school kid.
You said it's at 97.
He's been up to 97. You know, comfort zone 93, 95. And the thing about him we like the best is he can command the fastball. If you're going to take a high school pitcher, he better throw strikes. And in this ballpark, I mean, it's a few years away, obviously, but pitchers, they better be strike throwers. And this kid's got a good arm, and he can paint the corners for a young kid. And that was probably the thing that jumped out at us the most. How he would work in, out, up, and down. He trusts his fastball command, and it's huge.
Any signability concerns?
No. We've spent a lot of time with him, his family, his advisor, so we feel good about things.
You mentioned last week it was hard where you were picking to see everybody a lot, but it sounds like this is a kid you've seen quite a bit.
You know, we have history with him. And we saw him all spring. And I went in towards the end, and I walked out of the ballpark saying, I hope this guy's there when we pick. I don't think so. But he made an impression on me, and our scouts have liked him for the last 3 years. Then we brought him out to Safeco, and he got looked at by our doctors. He threw in the workout, and he was, you know, thumbs up, ready to go. And he impressed, and we're excited to have him.
And here is Nick, and the first thing he does is describes himself as a pitcher.
I know a lot of people say that that I remind them of Tim Hudson because I'm not very tall, I stride out pretty far like he does, and my changeup is actually one of my more dominant pitches.
How's the elbow?
Oh, it's good. It's 100% healthy.
Did you have an idea that the Mariners were pretty interested in you?
Yeah, I had a good idea just by the contact we've been having with them throughout my baseball season and leading up to the draft. We were talking to them very consistently.
How much do you know about the Mariners? Because of that, did you kind of look into them some more?
You know what? I wish I could say I knew a lot about them, but I'm all the way on the East Coast and don't hear much about them except on SportsCenter. But I know the fan base there is incredible, and they really support King Felix and the Mariners. So just to be a part of that family is just amazing.
How much have you been, you know, thinking about pro baseball? I mean, did you kind of grow up looking at this? How big a day is this for you?
This is a huge day because ever since I was a kid, I always dreamed about getting the opportunity to play professional baseball. And just to be able to play for just an amazing city and ball club is just amazing to me.
And then with their second pick, taking a local product, Andrew Moore has been the ace of the Oregon State staff. He has had a decorated career. And we'll talk more about Andrew Moore as we move through the next couple of podcasts. But here is what Tom McNamara had to say about the Oregon State hurler.
Andrew Moore?
Yeah.
We're to get a local guy was special to us, but we wanted to take, you know, it was a tough call because there's, with the college pitchers on Friday night, there's usually the best pitcher on each Division I college team goes on Friday night. And we saw Moore in Team USA in the summer in the Cape. And I saw him against the University of Washington this year. I came home and I saw three or four high school arms, and then I went in to see Oregon State and Washington. And what I saw was another guy that could really command his fastball. He was 92 to 94 for 8 innings. And I think the thing about him that really impressed all of us is his body language and his fastball command. And I talked to the head coach at Oregon State today. I talked to the head coach at University of Washington. I talked to the coach at Team USA. So we kind of had a good idea that this was our targeted guy, just to get as much information as possible. He's from Eugene. He's got tilt and downhill plane for a 6'1" guy. He's put together. But he can sink it, he can cut it, and he commands his fastball very well. And he's got a good slider, and he's got feel for a change. And we were keeping our fingers crossed. I mean, you pick out certain guys, you got to wait. And this year we had to wait. And I'd like to say it was a lot of fun, but I'm glad we got the first two guys done.
Andrew Moore had an excellent year for Oregon State. Of course, that has been one of the best programs in college baseball the last handful of years. They've won a couple of national championships under Pat Casey. They've sent a ton of guys to pro baseball, to the major leagues, including Jacoby Ellsbury and Darwin Barney. And, it's a nice, solid list of guys. Cole Gillespie was just with the M's not too long ago as well. But Andrew Moore has been the Friday night guy. He's been the ace this year, 7-2 with a 1.91 ERA in 16 starts through 122 innings. Pretty good for college baseball. 111 punch outs, opponents batting 200 against him. Doesn't overwhelm you with stuff, but knows how to pitch. Has a mastery of the strike zone. Not a big guy at all, under 6 foot. Doesn't throw particularly hard, but knows what he's doing. Knows what he's doing on the mound. Three-pitch pitcher. He's got a fastball, a change, works in a curve as well. And a guy that could get to the big leagues fairly quickly. And again, we'll have more on Andrew Moore coming up in later podcasts. From future Mariners to now current Mariner, let's meet Vidal Nuño.
It's been a wild few days for you. First, you find yourself pitching in a 17-inning ball game. Mm-hmm. You get traded a few days later. What has the last few days been like for you?
Nothing that's driving me nuts and everything, but it's just it's day by day, and it's just work and baseball. So I'm just used to it and just going out there and just having fun with it. So.
You've been traded before from the Yankees to the Diamondbacks. How much does that experience help you this time around?
Getting acquired by the Mariners is amazing. That has another shot and another opportunity to come out here and handle business and compete and give the team extra length in the bullpen and get their innings in. So, but yeah, it's been fun so far, and every day is exciting. So,
you mentioned opportunity. Your opportunity to get to the big leagues. It's quite a story how you got here. It started at Baker University. One major league player before you got there in the entire history of the school. What led you to Baker?
It was just scholarships and everything. A couple buddies went out there, and I just took a chance. And scouts just told me, you just got to get out of San Diego. It's just you got to explore a little bit. So that's what I did, and it was a good opportunity for me to see Kansas and handle business out there. So that's what I did.
You were drafted by the Indians, then released, and you're pitching in the independent leagues. Mm-hmm. And then just 2 years later, you get signed by the Yankees, you rocket through the system, you're in the big leagues just a couple years after that. How did you rise so quickly from pitching in the independent leagues to a big league uniform with the Yankees?
Well, it was just a pitching coach just telling me what I got to do, listen to them, take the knowledge of their game and pursued on to mine, and just work ethic was a key to going out to the park and with my friends and getting my throwing program in and finding that change up, finding that cutter. So it came a long ways. Before in college I was a two pitch pitcher. Now I'm pretty much a six, and better command and everything, velo's up. So now it's just rock and roll, and can't wait to get in the game. So,
how do you describe yourself for fans that haven't seen you? How do you describe yourself as a pitcher?
Pretty much, I command everything. So, it's just having that drive to not be scared and not to be intimidated by these hitters and go after them. So, just take everything in and just handle business out there.
With your time with the Yankees, you shared a clubhouse with two of the best lefties we've seen in the last couple of decades. Andy Pettit was there, CeCe Sabathia there as well. Is there anything you took from them with your time with New York?
Actually, just seeing them like working, and I see how they throw the bullpens and stuff like that, be around their atmosphere, and then take on to mine and go on from there. So yeah, it is exciting to see all that happening, and sure or not, I just wanted to talk to them a little bit and learn how they throw their cutters and how they approach their hitters, and it goes on from there. So
well, welcome to Seattle. Thanks for the time. We certainly appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Now, from current Mariner to former Mariner, now broadcaster Dave Valle, this is a story he told that never made the air, which is, I think, is outstanding. But here it is, Dave Valle, and it starts by him talking about the trade. And he was a guy that was traded in midseason and what it's like.
Valle, I want to talk to you about what Mark Trumbull went through yesterday, just a couple of days ago. He was an Arizona Diamondback, the trade a few days ago, yesterday in a Mariners uniform. He goes 2-for-4 last night. You moved around in your baseball career. I think one time you were traded during the course of the season, one club to another. How tough is that during the course of the year to go from one team to another?
Well, Rick, there's a lot of things that kind of go through your mind once the day that you find out actually about the trade. Do you have a family? Do you have children? Are the children in school at that time? Mine were actually, I was in Boston playing for the Red Sox in 1994, and the kids were in school, and, you know, you've rented a house for the summer, you know, for the entire season, and now you're getting on a plane, and you're flying into Milwaukee thinking, okay, where am I going to live? I got to find an apartment. I don't have furniture here. Oh, I got to go rent some furniture. So when I got there, I was really fortunate. I went up to the offices, signed my new contract with the Milwaukee Brewers, and so I still started asking people because I didn't know Milwaukee. Right. Like, where should I live? Where do some of the guys live? And one of the people in the office said, you know, I think Robin Yount is renting his house. Is looking to rent his house. I'm like, I'll take it. You know, I was signing a scene, and it had furniture and everything. So, I do remember this because I'm thinking Robin Yount. I mean, Hall of Famer, played in the big leagues for 20 years. It must be a great home. So I got the address, found the house, and it was just this really unassuming three-bedroom rambler in a nice, quaint little neighborhood in Milwaukee. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking, you know, Robin yeah. would have, like, this yeah, big palatial spread there. But I went inside, and, the furniture was great, and I went downstairs because I saw there was a basement. I went downstairs, and he had boxes still there. And on top of one of the boxes was his MVP award, sitting in the basement just on top of a couple of boxes. I mean, it was just kind of funny. But overall, that was my own personal story. Right. But that made my transition a lot easier because, okay, now I knew I had a place for my family. They could fly in. And going to the team, though, I don't know if you remember, Milwaukee was the team that we had a lot of history with when I right. played with the Mariners, a lot of fights.
Billy Spires
was on that team as well. So I actually joined the team in New York at Yankee Stadium. Another crazy story, I got there in the afternoon, got on the subway. Subway broke down in the middle of Harlem. I got out, jumped in a cab. I got to Yankee Stadium and realized I forgot my wallet in the hotel room. So one of the security guys who knew me at Yankee Stadium lent me $20 so I could pay the taxi. And I went downstairs, got dressed. The guys were already on the field stretching, so I came out and I joined them. And Billy Spires was kind of like trying to hide from me.
Really?
You know, in jest, of course, but because of that slide that took out my right. knee the year before. But going to a team, I didn't know a lot of the players on that club personally because we had such severe fights and bouts with them when I was with the Mariners. So that was a little bit unique, you know, trying to fit in and find out who you connect with, who do I start to build relationships with. I have pitchers I got to get to know. So there's a lot going on than just showing up and playing baseball, starting with your family, making sure you get there on time, and then starting new relationships, because I had just gotten signed as a free agent with the Boston Red Sox. So those first 3 months of that year, I was building relationships with all those guys, and then it was like start all over again. So I think Trumbo will have Mark will have a little bit easier time because he doesn't have to worry about getting to know pitchers and, you know, working. He's going to be playing some outfield, some DH. So we saw that last night. He just jumped right back in there. That's what he does. He swings the baseball bat and got a couple of knocks last night. So hopefully his transition will be a little bit smoother than mine was.
I love the idea of, I mean, think about all the stuff in your attic or all the stuff in your basement. And but for Robin Yount, it's just, that's my MVP trophy. It's just in a cardboard box somewhere downstairs. That thought is so funny to me. Now speaking of funny, we're going to hand things over to Aaron Goldsmith with Terry Francona, who tells a couple of good funny stories. Hang on for this.
Tito, now in your 15th season as a big league manager, your managing career began back in 1997 with the Phillies. If you could go back and talk to a 38-year-old Terry Francona, what would you tell him?
You don't have enough time. I knew when I became a manager in Philadelphia that I still had a lot to learn. And I learned on the run, and probably a lot of times the hard way. I mean, being in Philadelphia and not having good teams that can be a pretty good test. And I think even though we weren't very good, I think it probably reinforced a lot of things that I believe in. And then when you get some experience and then you get a team that's pretty good, and if you still go by the same things you believe in, that's when you start to have success. I mean, I laugh when people are like, well, what'd you do so different? Nah, I didn't. We had better players. But I do think it was important and good for me to go through that because, I mean, I got beat up a lot. But I felt like I felt about the players, and I still believe that way. And just like players, you get put in situations and you gain confidence, and I think it helps.
When you were a player, did you envision becoming a manager?
No, I was trying so hard to hang on that I probably, without even noticing it, I probably was preparing. You know, as a pinch hitter off the bench, you're always paying attention of when maybe you're going to hit, things like that. But I was so desperately trying to stay on teams and show a manager that I could be worth, them having me on the team, that no, I really didn't. And even, till I got done, I hadn't really thought of it. Until Buddy Bell called me and offered me a job, I was taking a real estate course, and Buddy called me, and I gave my books to the to the teacher that night. I said, man, nobody's going to buy a house for me anyway. And flew down to Sarasota, Florida, and started coaching. And I loved it. It was the best decision I ever made.
During your playing days, you played in just a handful of games at the Kingdom. What do you remember about playing in that ballpark?
The one thing I actually remember is I saw the ball really well there. Because I didn't, you know, there was, especially at that point in my career, I had a lot of bad nights as opposed to good nights. But I know I hit a home run there and had some multiple hit games there, which were few and far in between by then. I just remember being able to see the ball really well.
In 1988, you were a member of the Cleveland Indians. There was a game that you played in the Kingdom. Rod Washington was the leadoff hitter. You hit second. And Bud Black was the starting pitcher. Three major league managers playing in one game. And I have to wonder what the conversations were like between Terry Francona and Rod Washington in one dugout. That must have been a hoot.
Well, and John Farrell was on that team, too. The funny thing was, is none of us ever envisioned being a manager. We all were trying to hang on. That team was more like the major league movie. I mean, we were 28 games out of first place. I remember Wash would come flying across the infield, make a play, and his hat would fly off, and I'd yell at him. I said, Wash, that's a good play, but, man, you got to keep your hat on. And I mean, we were so bad that we had to get along. And, I mean, you couldn't be arrogant on a team like that.
Your managing days began early in your career, before you got to the big leagues, in the minor leagues. And in 1994, you managed maybe the greatest athlete of all time, and yet he hit only 202 in 127 games in the Southern League in Birmingham, Alabama. Tito, what was it like managing Michael Jordan?
Well, you know, like players going through the minor leagues, you know, as a manager, you're trying to learn. And there's no better learning experience than being put in that position. I mean, you know, when you're in Double A, you're just happy to be on the radio. And all of a sudden, you know, you got Nightline and, I mean, people from, you know, Ted Koppel to, you know, and so I had to learn to be more organized, deal with the media. And like you said, maybe arguably the greatest athlete in the world. And it was a great learning experience for me. And I didn't realize it at the time. I was just trying to do my job and survive and get better. But when I look back, I was lucky that I was put in that position, because it was just luck of the draw. But it was a big, big help along the way.
As best as he could, did MJ fit in with the rest of the guys?
He was, and I try so hard to let people understand this, because, you know, back in that time, it was pretty fashionable to be critical of him. Right. And I thought he handled himself so well and with so much grace, and he respected the game of baseball so much that it was really easy to be patient with him, because he didn't know a lot about baseball. Thought the fact that he hit 200 was actually pretty amazing, because he hadn't played baseball since high school. And he got beat up sometimes, but he loved it. I loved how he respected the game. I loved how he respected his teammates and the staff. And when you really think about it, there's no way a guy could be that good in another sport without being smart, competitive, respectful, all those things, and he had it.
In your book, you talk about in the early 2000s when you actually came here to Seattle to interview to become the Seattle Mariners manager, but things did not go quite according to plan. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, in the nutshell version is I flew out here and I just had some surgery, and I had blood clots that turned into a pulmonary embolism, and which is bad news. And, you know, I was too dumb to even know. But I showed up at the interview about 3 hours early because I just couldn't sit still. And then when Pat Gillis started interviewing me, there were times when I literally had to ask him to repeat the question, and I was clutching my side and I was sweating and turning red. And I can remember thinking to myself, this is just what they want to see in a manager. You know, you get asked a tough question and you're perspiring and you're short of breath. And then when Pat found out what happened, he ended up calling me about a week later, and he felt bad. And I said, Pat, the questions almost killed me. And, you know, it wasn't funny at the time, but have gotten far enough removed now, or it is, but it was pretty serious.
Tito, it's always a real treat. Thank you so much for the time.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Great stuff. And finally, we'll hand things over to the great Dave Niehaus and his reading of Casey at the Bat.
This weekend, we celebrate the 118th birthday of arguably the most famous piece of baseball prose ever written. It was written by Ernest Lawrence Thayer for the San Francisco Examiner, June 3rd, 1888. And, of course, it's Casey at the Bat. The outlook wasn't brilliant for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-2 with but one inning more to play. And then when Cooney died at first and Barrows did the same, a pall-like silence fell upon the patrons of the game. The straggling few got up to go in deep despair. The rest clung to that hope which springs eternal in the human breast. They thought if only Casey could but get a whack at that, we'd put up even money now with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, as did also Jimmy Blake, and the former was a hoodoo, while the latter was a cake. So upon that stricken multitude, grim melancholy sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single, to the wonderment of all, and Blake, the much despised, tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted and the men saw what had occurred, there was Jimmy safe at second, and Flynn a-hugging third. And then from 5,000 throats and more, there rose a lusty yell. It rumbled through the valley. It rattled in the dell. It pounded on the mountain and recoiled upon the flat. For Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing, and a smile lit Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his cap. No stranger in the crowd could doubt 'twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded when he wiped them on his shirt. Then, while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance flashed in Casey's eyes, and a sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurtling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. "That ain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the umpire said. From the benches, black with people, there went up a muffled roar, like the beating of the storm waves on a stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" shouted someone on the stand. And it's likely they'd have killed him had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the raging tumult. He bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and once more the dun sphere flew, but Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "Strike two." "Fraud!" cried the maddened thousands, and echo answered, "Fraud!" But one scornful look from Casey, and the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold. They saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey wouldn't let that ball go by again. The sneer has fled from Casey's lip. The teeth are clenched in hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Somewhere in this favored land, the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light, and somewhere men are laughing, and little children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out.